This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford. Coming up, why won't the major U.S. civil rights organizations disclose where they get their money? A discussion of biosexual politics and black mass incarceration, and democracy in America enters the land of the living dead. But first, a national conference is set for this weekend to kick off a drive to collect 50,000 signatures to put a $15 an hour minimum wage on the ballot in Seattle, Washington. The wage hike has gained phenomenal support since Keshama Sawant of the Socialist Alternative Party won a seat on the city council last year. Now, the corporate establishment and the rest of the city council claim they also support $15 an hour. We asked Jess Speer, the organizing director for the 15 Now campaign, why it's necessary to put the issue on the ballot.
Well, we have to be aware that the city council is going to be pressured and lobbied daily, if not hourly, by big business. Big business has just launched their own organizing effort called One Seattle, which appears to be an AstroTurf organization in that it's funded and directed by big business, but the face of it is small businesses and nonprofits. And they're really pressuring for total compensation and tip penalty, both of which are not good for workers. They're a step backwards for our state.
Explain what total compensation means. They want to fold all employee benefits into a package and say that's worth $15 an hour.
Correct. They would like to deduct health care benefits, deduct paid sick leave, deduct, you know, bus passes. They haven't really defined exactly what they want to deduct from workers' wages. But yes, the whole point is to say, well, we're already paying 15, and many workers would see no increase in their take-home pay at all.
In fact, some people speculate that there are some workers that this might actually amount to a decrease in wages.
It could, yes, especially as healthcare costs increase larger than overall inflation. As the credit that employers get for healthcare costs goes up, you could see your take-home pay go down. And we don't know. That's what they're pressuring the city council on. And it's not surprising. There's so much support for 15 in this city that business does not dare come out and oppose 15 outright. So they're looking for loopholes and carve-outs to undermine a real 15. So we have initiated a ballot measure for two reasons. The first is to have a people's megaphone so that our demands are amplified and heard by the city council that we need 15, we deserve 15, and if you want to continue to represent us, you need to deliver a real 15. It also serves as the people's safety net. Should the city council side with corporate interests against workers, this would be a way for workers to have a backup plan, to put it to the voters, to deliver a real 15 minimum wage to all workers on the November ballot.
So everybody on the city council would know that it doesn't end with them.
Correct, yes. And we would be collecting signatures, and we'd be out there in the streets talking to our community members at the same time that they're debating and discussing their proposals. So it's a way for us to continue to keep up the pressure on the city council.
In a sense, you've already won part of the political battle in that even the AstroTurf organization has to pretend that it's for 15 an hour.
Correct. Yes, we've won that debate. They cannot come out against it. What they're trying to do right now is confuse workers. We've heard they've been talking to their workers. You know, they have a captive audience. Many of these business owners can call meetings, force their workers to attend, and tell them if this passes, you'll lose your job, you won't get tips, and you need to be out there advocating for a tip penalty. You need to be out there advocating for total compensation and doing a lot of fear-mongering with workers.
Yes, that old story about the apocalypse that follows naturally from wage hikes.
Exactly, yes. The same old, the sky's going to fall, local businesses will shut down, big business will move out of the state. All the same things we always hear when workers are demanding their rights are pulled out, recycled, dusted off, and used again. to scare workers into voting against their own interests or not getting involved in this exciting historic movement. And we've talked with workers that have told us about this, and we've convinced them that it's necessary to have solidarity with the movement to support themselves. They need to build a network to fight against this scare tactic that their employers are using against them.
Well, the eyes of the country and the world are on Seattle. What are you doing besides the organizing in terms of gathering signatures? What are you doing to tell the Seattle story to the rest of the country?
Well, one thing that we're doing is bringing people like yourself out here so they can witness what's happening in Seattle and report that to the national media. There has been national media interest for a few months now. The New York Times, PBS have all sent people out here to witness what's happening so that the rest of the nation can understand that it is the time to fight back against this race to the bottom. We don't have to continue to accept these poverty wages. We can fight back against it. Big business is making record profits. There's no reason why they can't pay more. We are worth more. So we're doing what we can to get this story out there, and we're very happy to have you coming to our conference and to let people know what's happening in Seattle, because we know a win here can spark a national movement. It can inspire workers, not only in this country, but internationally, to really fight back against not only poverty wages, but austerity, the very idea that our social services have to be cut in order to pay for their crisis.
And how helpful or unhelpful has organized labor in Seattle been?
They've been helpful in organizing the effort. For over a year now, different labor unions have started campaigns with Fast Food Forward. Here locally in Seattle, there are a number of campaigns that have been started by SEIU that have helped to organize workers and give them the tools to begin their fight back. But in general, organized labor, I think, has a different idea of how to get it done, and it involves negotiating and sitting at the table with big business. And I think they are betting on big business getting in and allowing this $15 an hour minimum wage to pass without a big fight. And our perspective has always been that's not going to happen. Big business isn't going to let this go without a fight. It doesn't matter how skillful we are at the negotiating table. We have to build a movement that is powerful enough to force the elected officials to do what's right by workers. We can't sit across from the table with big business and expect to get a deal that's going to calm them down. There's no example in history, as far as I know, that shows that that's possible. So our organization has always been about building a movement, not only to fight for 15, but so we can rebuild the workers' movement to fight for more things, to fight for progressive taxation, to fight for a green jobs program so we can begin to deal with climate change and unemployment. So that's our perspective, and we hope that labor will join us in the signature collection campaign and join us with the real battle against big business. I think once the mayor advisory committee here in Seattle is done talking about their proposals and they put forward something to the city council, I think it'll be very obvious at that point that they're unwilling to bend on the carve-outs and the loopholes that they want. And I think labor at that point will hopefully come back to us and join us in this struggle in the streets for a real 15.
Labor's identification with the Democratic Party is all but total. And the Democratic Party, I'm sure, has been embarrassed in Seattle that this movement, this push, is led by Socialist Alternative.
Yeah, I think that's correct. We have a new Democratic mayor who's also the first gay mayor in Seattle. And I don't think he's too happy that he's being overshadowed by a city council member who's been a bold advocate for, you know, a long time for workers' rights and has really overshadowed his win and has been driving the agenda. Not only herself, but the movement that she represents has been driving the debate, has been setting the pace for how quickly we need to get this done. And I think that's not a comfortable situation for the new mayor. And yeah, you're correct in saying that labor in generally is tied at the hip to the Democrats. But even in Washington State, you can start to see some labor unions questioning this. The machinist union here at, you know, with Boeing being very upset with the governor and other Democrats passing an $8.7 billion handout to Boeing, and recent news that Boeing will be letting go 2,000 engineers. You know, there's no guarantee that they weren't going to do this, even though we gave them so much money. And the fact that they meddled in this union contract negotiation really upset a lot of the rank-and-file members of the machinist union. So I think that labor is starting to see that the Democrats are not their ally. But we need to see more labor unions stepping away and supporting independent candidates like Shama Sawant and the Socialist Alternative Party.
The conference that's coming up is organized by 15 Now. What's the difference between 15 Now and Socialist Alternative?
15 Now is a broad group of people that want to fight for a $15 an hour minimum wage. Socialist Alternative initiated this campaign so that we can involve community in this fight. All the different organizing campaigns over the past year that have been run by labor unions really were only available for workers to get involved in. And we saw massive support with the election of Shama Sawant, that a lot of people wanted to get involved in the fight for 15. So this was a way to involve the community. And we have lots of different people that are involved, not just socialists, but Democrats, Green Party activists, community organizations, Latino organizations that are fighting for immigration reform. So it's a broad group of people from, you know, different sections of the left. And Socialist Alternative is a socialist organization, and we fight for social and economic justice and see the need for democratic socialism to replace capitalism so that we can really deal with all the problems that plague society. And we see capitalism as a barrier to dealing with things like women's oppression, racism, climate change, income inequality. Our perspective is all those things cannot be fully dealt with until we deal with the problem of capitalism. But you don't have to be a socialist to get involved in 15 Now. You can be involved even if you're a Republican. It would be surprising, but if you are and you want to fight for 15 and you agree with how we're going to fight for 15 by building a movement, then there's no problem with getting involved.
That was Jess Speer of Socialist Alternative. The 15 Now National Conference will be held in Seattle this Saturday. The U.S. Supreme Court has decreed that the power of money is the law of the land. The High Court's McCutcheon decision allows the rich to spend virtually unlimited money on political campaigns as a matter of free speech. Ajamu Baraka, a veteran organizer and editor and columnist for Black Agenda Report, says the McCutcheon ruling signals that the United States has become a zombie democracy.
Basically, they like The Walking Dead. It looks like democracy. It can sometimes sound like democracy. But basically, what we're talking about is a system that doesn't really function. It's a system that has no internal life. And the recent decision by the Supreme Court just merely affirmed that. That basically what we have here is the semblance of democracy. That's always been the case. From the very beginning of this republic, people have to remember that this was not set up as a democracy. It was set up as a republic. And the only elements in society that had an ability to participate were white men with property. And what we have now is a full circle back to that reality. Even though in the course of 200 years, as a consequence of the struggles of people to bring some degree of life to this democracy, winning the right to vote, expanding that right to women and the African Americans and others. We have seen now over the last few years a full circle back to propping up the essential point of this so-called democracy. And that is that the only ones who have real democracy, the only ones that have real power are those white men with massive property.
And you've described the recent Supreme Court McCutcheon decision as inaugurating a democratic zombie apocalypse.
We know from popular culture that when you realize you are in that zombie apocalypse, you only have one alternative. You have to put those zombies down. And so basically we have a situation now where now it's clear that this democracy is the walking dead. If you believe in the possibility of democracy, then we don't play with the fact that we have this semblance. Let's remove this phony facade and let's build something that's real. So we have a challenge to both fight for our democratic rights while at the same time advocating and struggling for real fundamental democratic transformation.
Well, is this a real change of kind or just one of degree?
Well, it's been a process. This McCutcheon case was the final nail in the coffin, if you will, using all these morbid sort of metaphors, but it stripped away any pretense to a democratic form here in this country. That basically what has occurred now is that, and has been proven now, and then even with some recent studies that have just come out from Princeton and other places, that what we have is oligarchy. And so this process, though, has really taken place in the last few years. Even though we've always had the rule of capital, because of the social and political realities in this country, capital couldn't just rule without any pretenses toward democratic participation and input. And there was always some degree of space for the people to be able to win certain kinds of concessions. But now in this new phase in which it appears that the rulers have concluded that even the pretense of democracy is a constraint on their ability to maintain and advance their dominance, now they are doing away with that pretense. So this is something that's different.
Both political parties have for a long time been up for sale, but now we have such a proliferation of billionaires and this Supreme Court decision that there are a small group of people that could buy both of those parties many times over.
They have, in fact, bought both those parties. That's why this whole phony debate about the so-called differences between the Republicans and Democrats is just that, a phony pretense. That basically what you have are disagreements based on sort of tactical sort of approaches by the two major corporate parties. But in terms of the fundamentals, even though you have divisions among the various factions of capital, there are still fundamental agreement on the trajectory, on the motion of capital. There is no disagreement on what the ultimate objective should be. And so basically, you know, what they have again done is to decide that it's going to be open rule by the bourgeoisie, and the rest of us would just get nothing but an opportunity every 2 to 4 years to come to the polls and decide what elements of the bourgeoisie are going to dominate us.
You write that the possibility of democracy was aborted by Thomas Jefferson and the rest of the white male property-owning settler so-called revolutionaries. But if that's who they were, was there ever any possibility?
Well, you know, those were the historical realities at that point. And what we have seen over the course of the history of the settler colony known as the U.S. Was, in fact, the attempts by people to struggle for and to win some degree of democracy. We know even though those struggles were taking place in the 1830s, under the Jacksonian Democrats and others, the colonial reality of the U.S. still was that for indigenous people, they were still being systematically eliminated. African people were still enslaved. But over the course of years, you've had this movement. You've had progressive elements in this country who are fighting for democratic rights, who are fighting for workers' rights, who were opposed to slavery, who advocated for sovereignty for indigenous people. So this thrust from the bottom up helped to bring some degree of democratic practice to this republic over the course of years. So there's always been some space within the state processes for those kinds of struggles, even though the overwhelming character of this system has always been the rule of capital. But again, in my opinion, you know, since the counter-revolution of the 1970s and forward, we have found that even those progressive advances have now been completely turned backward. And these series of cases, the Citizens United case and this recent McCutcheon case, has now basically solidified the fact that even the semblance of democracy is no longer acceptable.
What does the pending Trans-Pacific Partnership and other NAFTA-like international treaties mean in the context of this tightening noose of capital?
These international trade agreements are the most dramatic expressions of this move away from democracy, because contained within those agreements are basically to remove public accountability to economic activity. Is to remove decision-making for economic activity, which is the lifeblood of most societies, away from the public and to the private sector. So it's another example of the tightening up of the rule of the international bourgeoisie. that basically these agreements are meant to undermine whatever semblance of a democracy that may exist in various countries, and to provide the legal basis for the rule of the financial and corporate elite. I mean, you even have situations now in those agreements where basically nations, sovereign nations, are no longer able to protect themselves from the legal encroachments of corporations. That if they decide to pass a law to protect their ecosystem or some emerging industry, if it's been determined that it impinges on the ability of some transnational corporation to make money in that country, then they have opened up themselves for a legal suit, and one in which they are probably going to lose. So this is a new reality of neoliberal rule. And if we don't put a stop to this, then basically we're going to have the kind of nightmare scenario that we see in these futuristic movies, where you have basically people reduced to the level of totally controlled sheep.
And so the possibilities for democracy in the United States and the world depend upon throwing off the rule of capital.
There's no other choice. Democracy and capitalism are incompatible. And that, I think, is the understanding that more and more people are coming to.
Ajamu Baraka, editor and columnist for Black Agenda Report. Social justice organizations held demonstrations in seven cities earlier this month in a focus on fusion centers, part of the government's vast spy network. Jamie Garcia works with a group called Stop LAPD Spying. She explains what the fusion centers are up to.
Fusion centers are basically what we like to call mega spy centers that collect and store information that's supplied by various law enforcement agencies. So once this information is supplied, it's uploaded into databases. And in 2004, there was a directive by the president that he wanted to create this ICE environment, which is an information sharing environment that makes every other local, state, and federal agency, including private contractors, able to access these files that are uploaded. And there's basically 85 fusion centers in the United States. And I'm from Los Angeles, and we house one of the largest in the country in Norwalk, California, and that fusion center is known as the Joint Regional Intelligence Center.
I've seen some of these fusion center reports. They are a mess. They include all kinds of accusations that make just regular demonstrators appear to be threats to world security. Is that your experience with the fusion center in L.A.?
The troubling part about fusion centers is there's not a lot of transparency. So there have been a few abilities to get reports released regarding what type of information is housed in these fusion centers and who particularly they're targeting. There's actually two cases that I wouldn't mind just identifying that are particularly focused on social justice organizers and activists. In 2013, a report entitled Dissent or Terror, How the Nation's Counterterrorism Apparatus in Partnership with Corporate America Turned on Occupy Wall Street. So this was released by DBA Press and the Center for Media and Democracy in June of 2012, and it details efforts of law enforcement personnel involved in the Arizona Counterterrorism Information Center, which is their fusion center in Arizona, tracking activities of Phoenix area activists through the first half of 2012, which is essentially during the time Occupy was very active. What's interesting about that is these rallies, one rally was against a police officer who had killed six citizens. You know, obviously the community was very much upset about this, was deciding to organize a protest and demonstration. And there was basically open investigation, trying to find out who these people were, identifying what they were doing, and nowhere in the records does it indicate that there was any kind of criminal activity going on. There was also a case up in Olympia, Washington, where an individual identified as John Towery was an employee of the U.S. military, and he posed as an anti-war organizer and infiltrated the Port Militarization Resistance Group, who basically nonviolently attempted to disrupt military shipments headed to Iraq and Afghanistan. Towery was discovered to be an informant from the military and also associated to fusion centers. Now, the lawsuit expanded to include a Chris Adamson, who was described by plaintiffs as being a member of the Pierce County Sheriff's Department and a director of the Regional Intelligence Group with the Washington Joint Analytical Center, which became known as the Washington State Fusion Center. So Mr. Adams helped coordinate Mr. Kauri's spying efforts and listed at least four protesters in a national domestic terrorist database with pictures identifying them and false claims that they had a propensity towards violence. These are two very clear examples of how there's this kind of guise that they are trying to keep us safe from terrorist activities, from these, you know, outrageous individuals that, you know, want to come and inflict harm on our communities. But what we're finding out through very difficult court cases to release information from fusion centers is that they're actively targeting social justice organizers.
Your organization, which is Stop LAPD Spying, has enough of a problem with the local police. How do the fusion centers further complicate your lives and the lives of other activists?
I think what essentially happened, I was actually involved in the Occupy movement here in Los Angeles. You know, and I was a registered nurse. I kind of went down. I had a very strong belief in single payer movement, went down to participate, to be in the marches, to be with the people, to kind of really show this indignation. When I first experienced my first teach-in with Stop LAPD Spying, I realized that there was a larger and more insidious surveillance apparatus that was occurring, and that my, you know, practicing of my First Amendment rights to protest, my freedom of speech, was actually now being categorized as possibly like a domestic terrorist, someone who was dangerous, someone that I could possibly have a file opened on me. Now, this is particularly because Stop LAPD Spying, we're not just focused on the fusion centers. Part of the campaign is really trying to show people how local, everyday activities are being surveilled and data is being collected. So going back to how your everyday political organizer is being kind of targeted for wanting to expose, wanting to discuss what does public safety mean, we have to know in the back of our brains by just when we look at the Suspicious Activity Report Initiative, Special Order 1 that comes out of Los Angeles and works in conjunction with the Fusion Center. So these Suspicious Activity Reports are uploaded into the Fusion Center. They particularly target non-criminal behavior, very innocent everyday behavior. So if you're taking photography in public, so if you're using binoculars in public, if you're drawing in public, if you go into a business and ask for hours of operation, you could possibly be suspect. So now we have a huge amount of demonstrators on the streets. We have people that want to organize a protest or a demonstration, go into an office, ask, you know, what's the business hours here? You know, it's Walmart. I've decided, you know, we're going to petition outside of Walmart. You can be considered a suspicious person. So in some ways, it really depoliticizes people because it makes people think, well, they're watching me. They could possibly think I'm doing something more than just discussing what my government's doing, practicing my First Amendment, right? So in those ways, I feel that, you know, we have this double-edged sword of trying to inform the community about what's going on, but at the same time, trying to, in that informing them and opening their eyes, at the same time, trying to not depoliticize them and saying, you know, this does seem like a huge, huge apparatus that is looking to criminalize our everyday behaviors, but we must continue to organize and talk about it.
In practice, are cops on the beat getting access to these fusion center reports and then looking at the folks that they are observing at demonstrations with a different kind of eye, looking at them as if they are terrorists and as if the government confirms that they are?
Well, one of the things that we do know when we look at the expansiveness of this program, through the Government Accountability Office, they published a report in March of 2013 that discussed the National SARS program. So what we do know is that this program is massive, and there are 14,200 law enforcement agencies that now have the capacity to share SARS. So what we do know is that if you are in Van Nuys and say you are doing something in Van Nuys, there was anti-foreclosure movements going on there where people were actually trying to resist and do a First Amendment demonstration regarding what they considered through their own research an unjust and unlawful foreclosure. So those people in Van Nuys are doing something. Police come around, have the capacity to write a SARS, right? And this is the other catch. SARS are not available to us. There's no smoking gun. They're not available to us through a Public Records Act or through the Freedom of Information Act. You actually have to go through a court battle. So as your everyday individual citizen, you have to have the funds and the resources to be able to go through kind of a court battle to obtain this. So what we do know through information that was released from ACLU and through other sources is that, and going back to this GAO report, is that law enforcement agencies are all a part of this information sharing environment. So you're in Van Nuys, you're involved in an anti-foreclosure activity, right? Practicing your First Amendment right. Then you decide to join with a group that's discussing, you know, organization police. Well, if you go to that demonstration, maybe across town, law enforcement has an apparatus to share that information with a law enforcement agency in that other city. And that's the whole point of the information sharing environment. That's part of what the Fusion Center does. It allows law enforcement agencies on a local, on a regional, on a state, on a national level to share information on non-criminal behaviors.
So basically, one local police department can tell another police department that one of their politically dangerous people is headed your way.
Exactly. They'll obviously be surveilled. They'll be looked at the lens of being guilty. This person needs to be watched. This person is choosing to speak out. Therefore, they are possibly dangerous. And, you know, and so that's the unfortunate part. That's the depoliticization that starts to happen, is that when people realize this, they realize, wow, like every moment I make, they are collecting data. And the Fusion Center is part and parcel of a larger surveillance complex that's kind of establishing itself under these new concepts or constructs called intelligence-led policing. So essentially, this is the wave of the future, gathering as much information on people that you can in order to share it, analyze it, and possibly predict and prevent something dangerous from happening. So essentially, we no longer have innocent until proven guilty. We have guilty. Now let's figure out if you're innocent.
That sounds like political profiling on steroids.
Definitely. And of course, one of the principles that the coalition is founded on is that this is not a moment in time. This isn't something new that's just happened. We see this as a continuum in history. We know from the 60s that there was the COINTELPRO. They had a secret and illegal project conducted by the FBI to infiltrate, discredit, dismantle, disrupt, and neutralize the social justice movement, one of the largest social justice movements of that time, that at one point opened up so many doorways for so many individuals that had been disenfranchised under the United States government. We know that LAPD had the Public Disorder Intelligence Division in the 1980s. This exposed to have illegally kept over 2 million documents on 55,000 individuals on groups engaging in constitutionally protected activities, human and civil rights activists and public officials, including the mayor, Tom Bradley. So, yeah, this isn't something new. This is just something on steroids and something being legitimized and being something that is being legalized.
Jamie Garcia of Stop LAPD Spying. The government of Rwanda has been repeatedly implicated in the genocide in the neighboring Democratic Republic of Congo, where 6 million people have died. The slaughter in Congo is the worst genocide since World War II. Yet many more people in the West are aware only of the much smaller mass killing in Rwanda, the 20th anniversary of which made big headlines in the corporate media. Maurice Carney is executive director of Friends of Congo. He's been touring the country, educating Americans about Rwanda's and the U.S. government's complicity in the Congolese genocide.
The Rwandan government has quite a few allies here in the West in the media. CNN is a key outlet for Rwandan President Paul Kagame, I mean, not in the least of which because of its ties in Atlanta with Andrew Young and Turner. So then you have figures like Bill Clinton and Tony Blair, and who are basically spokespersons for the Rwandan regime. There's no crime that Rwandan regime can commit that Blair and Clinton, you know, won't cover or smooth over for them. So they have very powerful forces here in the West. That's something that we have to cut through. But once we lay out the role that American citizens' tax dollars play in propping up the regime and supporting the Rwandan regime through U.S. financing, arming, training, provision of military equipment, intelligence, and even providing diplomatic and political cover at the international level, once we lay that out to people, they understand the nature of the game, and they understand why it is that millions of people could have lost their lives in the last 18 years or so in the heart of Africa, and that they know very little about it. So once the average person understands the nature of the game, what is at stake, how it is being played with their fund, with their dollars, without their knowing, then they're ready for action.
Are people shocked when you use the term genocide and you're speaking of Congo, a much larger loss of life, 6 million possibly people since 1996, than occurred in Rwanda? Are people shocked at that story?
They're shocked about the story, and they're shocked that they didn't know about the story, but they're the ones who use the term genocide before we even get it out of our mouths. And people we're talking about people in religious institutions, churches, community folks, and community organizations. We're talking about folks who come out to museums to see our film screenings. We spoke to high school students, elementary school students, university students, community activists. Groups are involved in peace and human rights action, civil rights action. So it's a broad cross-section of the community that we engage. And they immediately recognize that their getting involved is a sign, an indication of the value that they hold for black lives. They don't make a distinction between what's taking place in the south side of Chicago or in Detroit to what's happening in the Congo. In fact, the folks in Detroit raised the issue when we laid out what's really at stake in the Congo, and that is Congolese controlling and determining the affairs of the Congo. That immediately resonated with some folks in Detroit because they've just been taken over, and they're not able to control and determine the affairs of Detroit. So there's an immediate solidarity there where black folks, whether they're in Detroit or in the Congo, have the same pursuit. That is to control and determine the affairs of their communities, if we're talking about Detroit, and their country, if we're talking about the Congo. And that's really what's at stake for people of African ancestry. You know, who's going to control the enormous resources that we have in our communities, and who's going to benefit from those resources?
The main and immediate perpetrators of the Congolese genocide are the governments of Rwanda and Uganda, but those governments have been backed by a succession of three U.S. presidents. Do Americans make the connection of U.S. complicity in that genocide?
Definitely. You know, we laid out for them how the Clinton administration had established the principle or the idea of these Renaissance leaders, these new breed of African leaders in the heart of Africa, and how that principle has been carried on through the Bush administration and then, of course, the Obama administration. What they're particularly surprised about is when we share with them the hyper-militarization of the African continent under the Obama administration, how it is that it was AFRICOM in cahoots with NATO that led the bombing of Libya. You know, how the Washington Post and some other media reported that their special operation troops, U.S. special ops, in some 35 African countries. How Mother Jones reported recently that some 40-odd African countries, there's U.S. military engagement. So they're surprised about the increased militarization of the African continent under Obama administration. Then we share with them how it is that this is part of U.S. strategic pursuit of control to access of resources on the African continent, in that the United States is not equipped, neither is Europe, to compete with China on the economic front. And China is establishing mineral for infrastructure deals in the Congo and elsewhere, and that the U.S. cannot compete on that economic level. However, its strength is its military and the militarization of the African continent under the auspices or the guise of combating terrorists. When you dig deeper, you see that the U.S. is really securing its strategic interests through its military presence throughout the continent.
But there is resistance when you speak to black American audiences associating Barack Obama with that kind of imperial reach.
You know, interestingly enough, there's very little resistance, because when people are exposed to the facts, it's not like we're making this up. I think there's, I would say, more surprise than resistance, because folks are not exposed to information about the continent other than some of the sources that you and I have discussed earlier in this interview. So once they see the abundance of evidence, you know, that's presented, then there isn't much room for resistance. It's more resignation than resistance. We get more resignation, like, oh man, you know, our brother's doing this to the continent. So that's really the top response that we get.
Congo's problems aren't just from external factors. The country is run by a government that is not representative necessarily of the masses of its people.
Absolutely. I'm glad you brought that up, because this is what people get most excited about, and that we share with them the youth movement that's on the way in the Congo, and how the young people are organizing to bring about change in the country, and how they're organizing against their own narrow, greedy elites, and how those elites are connected to institutions in the West, whether we're talking about governments or corporations. So people are excited to see that Congolese are demonstrating agency, organizing throughout the country, establishing models of self-sufficiency, self-determination, and development that they can embrace. So when we engage local communities, we articulate the external challenges and, of course, the internal challenges, but we also lay out for people what Congolese are doing, particularly the young people. As you know, Congo is a very young country. It's got a median age of 17. By comparison, the U.S. median age is over 40. So that's what people are most excited about. We're even able to connect the youth on the ground with communities in Chicago and Detroit and elsewhere through Skype. You know, when we go into the communities, we reach out to the young folks on the ground and connect them with using the technology. And they're able to articulate to folks on the south side of Chicago or folks in Detroit what they're doing in the heart of Africa, in the Congo, to bring about change, not just for Congolese, but for Africa overall. As you know, Congo is central to the future of the African continent. So whatever happens there in the Congo has implications for the continent as a whole.
Maurice Carney of Friends of Congo, speaking from Washington. At Vanderbilt University in Nashville recently, black activists and intellectuals came together for a workshop titled Black Folks in Dark Times. One of those on hand was David Austin, the Montreal, Canada-based activist and educator and author of Fear of a Black Nation. Austin talked about mass black incarceration in Canada and what he calls biosexual politics.
We do live and have long lived in a permanent state of exception, a liminal and libidinal existence in which black life chances have been circumscribed by the de facto and de jure practices of exclusion enacted on both our minds and our bodies. This is a practice that begins with slavery, yes, and colonization, and persists in Cynthia Hartman's afterlife, in which the ghosts of the past haunt the living present, and as the sins of former masters continue to be enacted by their sons on former slaves. This practice, what I call biosexuality or biosexual politics, a primeval fear of black folks that is rooted in the recurring need to control black bodies, is a phenomenon that is intimately connected to an ongoing fear of black rebellion and self-activity, and rooted in a primal fear of the biological and political spread of blackness as a political contagion, and a fear of both black-white solidarity and black-white sexual encounters. Biosexuality accounts for the high visibility of black subjects, a visibility that nonetheless renders black humanity both invisible and invisible in society at large. Whereas black bodies once represented a primary source of surplus labor, even if slavery did not quite figure in Marx's conception of labor as capital, black folks today are surplus laborers, excess and defunct, and hence part of the ongoing Du Boisian problem. This problem is not merely an American problem, but a Pan-American problem that begins in the complex of territories that comprise the Americas, when black labor was emancipated from the precarious stability of the plantation and into an uncertain freedom, and only to be made redundant in the plant, as in auto plant and factory, and to ultimately feed the appetite of the prison machine, an industry in which even the symbolic semblance of mutual recognition and codependence that characterized the former master slave regime is absent. A few months ago, I watched the film Finally Got the News, produced by the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, about black auto workers in 60s Detroit. This hyper-masculine militant film is, of course, of its time, but 40 years after it was produced, it still vividly captures how and why Detroit made the transition from Motown to a ghost town, with one of the highest rates of black criminalization in North America. It is perhaps in Detroit that we see the most vivid expression of the plantation to plant to prison trajectory. As the home of Motown Records, Detroit holds a special place in the Americas and the black diaspora. It was largely from that citadel of black music production, whose closest parallel is perhaps Kingston, Jamaica, and the production of reggae, a place where the heirs of the original Wailers, including Bob Marley, as their ears burned as they listened to Curtis Mayfield telling people to get ready. It was there in Detroit that blacks across the diaspora, the Caribbean and the African continent, renewed their sense of the black fantastic, to borrow a term from Richard Eyton, and the possibilities of freedom and creativity that engendered. Yet as Eyton reminds us, we have to our detriment yet to fully appreciate the place of art, popular culture, in the shaping of a black consciousness and aesthetic, a consciousness that relentlessly crosses borders and seascapes. But because of the heights to which it soared, Detroit I'm talking about, and Motown, it is perhaps there in Detroit that we witness the most stark representation of the plantation to plant to prison trajectory, as I mentioned. Fear of black self-organization and autonomy, and fear of its impact on the automobile industry's bottom line, led to the suburban flight, leaving behind what is often described as an urban wasteland, where black lives are consumed by the judicial system. But across the river in Canada, the land where black American slaves sought freedom, while black Canadian slaves fled across the border to free American states to escape their own bondage, black lives rot in prisons at an increasingly alarming rate. As a recent article in one of the country's national newspapers, the Globe and Mail, reports, blacks in Canada, though only 2.9% of the population, represent 10% of the country's prison population. Another report, this time on CBC, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, suggests that Canada's black prison population has increased by 75% since the year 2000. 75%. Not surprisingly, we not only are disproportionately represented in prisons, but languish there as second-tier citizens, even in prisons, or denigrated denizens on the margins of the margins, mirroring black life in the wider society. According to that same Globe and Mail article, black inmates are more likely than the general inmate population to do maximum time and to find themselves in solitary confinement. They are also more likely to face the use of force from guards, and they are less likely to hold prison jobs, and they're also less likely to be released on parole. This I also know from my own personal experience working with black youth, in particular in Montreal over the years. You can walk into a prison and find entire wards that's full of young black men. The unwanted presence of blacks in Canada challenges Canada's image as a peaceful, peacekeeping nation, which according to its mythical lore, has no history of colonialism. The uncomfortable presence of blacks forces Canada to confront its demons, ghosts of the past that were firmly rooted in the practice of empire, and not simply the British Empire, but Canada's own imperial designs that are typified in the history of Canadian banks and mining companies in the Caribbean. Part of Canada's interests that have contributed to underdevelopment in the Caribbean and the African continent, particularly when you think about mining interests, and the resultant migration to cities like Montreal and Toronto of people from these same countries in search of possibilities that are in limited supply in the global south. In slavery's afterlife, not only does the presence of blacks in Canada evoke a sense of dread, a threat to be monitored, policed, and contained, but also begs the question, what do you do with a surplus black population that disproportionately unemployed and underemployed represents an inherent social and, when organized, political threat to the state? The answer, or the state's answer, has been incarceration and extended policing. How, then, can we speak of citizenship when a racial hierarchy predicated on innate notions of social and biological intellectual inferiority has served to limit black life chances? What does citizenship mean in this context? As has been argued, a profound rethinking and questioning of the notion of citizenship is in order. To what extent have the entitlements of citizenship served the interests of the permanent black underclass? How has our investment in these entitlements harmed our human integrity insofar as, meager as these entitlements have been, we can no longer afford to turn a blind eye to the fact that they have come at the cost of bloodshed in the Congo? Think about the mining of coltan, for example, which is used in cell phones, and the perpetual destabilization and military intervention of countries like Haiti. How do we reconcile the investment in the prophylactic state, as Richard Eyton describes it, whose invisible ceiling serves to eclipse black life chances? How do we reconcile this and the phenomenon of what he describes as the duppy state in the global south? States that have been failed, as opposed to failed states, and whose paltry existence renders the notion of post-colonialism at its best an aspiration that is tragically far removed from the political horizon, a shattered dream whose twilight arrived before its dawn. What is our position? Where do we sit? What possibilities can we create? Are we confined to chanting down Babylon in a world of catastrophe whose implications have been deferred on credit, even as the calamity of social and environmental degradation suggests that we respond with a renewed sense of urgency? The Black diaspora, by virtue of its denigrated place, has long played an important, often central role in the exercise of social renewal and the practice of freedom. Here we visit what Eitan refers to as the diaspora's, quote, anarchist-infected imagination, permitting a presence both inside and outside, pushing for inclusion while recognizing its limitations within what he described as a prophylactic state. I would suggest that we have reached the limits of citizenship. The boundaries have been stretched and bent, but they do not break for the majority of Black folks. Like Agamben's notion of the refugee, which brings a radical crisis to the principles of the nation state, to be part of the diaspora means to have the potential to engender the courage and tenacity to challenge and confront the boundaries of national boundaries and contrived and self-serving practices of citizenship, to look at more complex and internationalist notions of Blackness and humanity, and to assume, as has historically been the case, both intellectually and politically, a leading role in creating a society, a world, that challenges the assumption not only of racial superiority, but of also human superiority, of which racial superiority is a facet, and to help bring us to a point where we can creatively create, kindle the Black fantastic, and imagine a shift, post-man in a sense to human, to borrow from Sylvia Winter, in which the seemingly impossible is made possible. The stark reality of our times, these dark times, I think demands nothing less.
Author and educator David Austin at the Black Folks in Dark Times workshop at Vanderbilt University in Nashville. Mainstream civil rights groups are determined to keep the sources of their funding secret. Whose privacy and interests are they trying to protect? Black Agenda Report managing editor Bruce Dixon has this commentary.
Leading civil rights organizations, the headline on a Politics365.com story said, challenge FCC rule limiting constitutional freedoms. Good thing, you might think. Our traditional civil rights bodies are on the lookout for threats to our constitutional freedoms, at least till you actually read the story. When you do, it turns out that the NAACP, the National Action Network, the National Urban League, the Hispanic Technology and Telecommunications Partnership, the League of United Latin American Citizens, and Rainbow Push all object to a proposed Federal Communications Commission rule that would force them, whenever they weigh in on matters before the FCC, to disclose who they're getting money from. 45 years after the death of Dr. Martin Luther King, all the mainline national civil rights organizations depend heavily upon donations from broadcasters and telecommunications corporations, from Comcast NBC to AT&T and Verizon to Time Warner, ABC Disney, Sprint, T-Mobile, and more. Some of their own top executives in recent years have come from these monopoly industries as well, and the deep pockets of broadcasters and telecoms have sponsored their own shadow organizations of minority entrepreneurs and spokespeople. All of them, from the NAACP, the National Action Network and PUSH, to LULAC, have in recent years backed state and federal legislation that keeps cities and towns from regulating cable networks or laying their own cable. They've all endorsed laws that bar cities and towns from spinning up their own broadband services, which might compete with those of their donors, or which might provide services to poor communities, to schools, libraries, and small businesses in their communities that their donors do not. Every one of these civil rights organizations opposes network neutrality and backs the digital redlining of Black, brown, and poor communities. Every one of these so-called civil rights organizations in recent years has backed the privatization or the outright giveaway to their wealthy donors vast amounts of the electromagnetic spectrum, which could and should have been set aside for community broadcasters and the public good. And of course, these corrupt civil rights organizations have unreservedly backed each and every proposed broadcaster and telecom merger, from AT&T's failed attempt to buy T-Mobile to the Comcast NBC deal. And they're lining up right now to back Comcast's current attempt to buy Time Warner Cable as well. whenever the interests of monopoly broadcasters and telecoms clash with the interests of poor black and brown people, these corrupt civil rights organizations always side with their funders, never with their people. Disclosing their financial ties to telecoms and broadcasters in the very same forum where they shill for their donors will make their pretense to represent the poor and oppressed even more ludicrous. 60 years ago, during the struggle against Jim Crow segregation, Southern state governments tried to force the NAACP to hand over membership and other lists. Back then, being on such a list could mean losing one's job, one's home, one's business, or one's life. A federal court ruled that the NAACP did not have to hand over its list. This, today's hypocritical civil rights organizations claim, as if the nameless and numberless families whose breadwinners lost their jobs or who were firebombed out of their homes or evicted from plantations like Fannie Lou Hamer are somehow equivalent to what might happen to Verizon and ABC Disney, is why they should be allowed to hide their donors. This is the constitutional freedom the black and brown misleaders of our civil rights organizations have mobilized to protect. It doesn't pass a smell test. It doesn't pass a laugh test. And it doesn't pass a hypocrisy test.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. And while you're there, check out the latest episode of Black Agenda Television. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the black left. I'm Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Martin Nuaga.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.